democracy. Through the decades, India was not only the center of the Sanskrit cosmopolis, but had it also become part of the extra-regional Persian world and was influenced by the Persian language and culture. As Richard M. Eaton has expressed in his book, India in the Persianate Age, not only did India accept the Persian language, but it was also quick to become a center for the manufacture of Persian culture. But in the 19th century, and with the expansion of the East India Company and the beginning of British colonialism in India, the English language gradually replaced Persian. In that time, learning English had become a path to success, and Indians who were looking to thrive and advance were forced to let go of their own culture, the Persian and Sanskrit culture, and become Englishmen. An exchange that would see the people of the subcontinent stray far from the rich culture of their predecessors.
Had the British not come into India in 1800s, you would not need an interpreter because we all used to speak Farsi. The court language for 600 years in India was Farsi.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Gohar Gilani, an author and journalist. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Gilani.
Thank you for having me in your show. Thank you very much.
As you know, November 9th is the birthday of Allama Iqbal Lahori. So, what effect did the philosophy and thought of this great thinker have on the self-confidence and the unity of Muslims around the subcontinent?
Well, you know that in the 20th century, there were several individuals, who played a key role in the revival and also the reform of Islam. And Allama Iqbal, who is popularly known as Allama Iqbal in South Asia, and Iqbal Lahori in Persia, in Iran. So he is one among those intellectual contributors in that sense. He wanted to emulate some of those to bring Muslims, especially at that time, there was turbulence in South Asia. There was British colonialism. India, the larger India, was under British control. And this man, Allama Iqbal, then had several, kind of correspondences with Muhammad Ali Jinnah. And then, the rest of the history, this was also a period when there was a sort of decline in the Muslim world. And this was the beginning of the British colonial era, and it was at its peak, actually. So in that sense, the role that Allama Iqbal played through his poetry and through his, body of work, and it could appeal to a large section of society, which included not only the youth, but also the children, and also intellectual thinkers. So in that sense, he has played a significant role as far as Muslim unity and strength is concerned.
Mr. Gilani, we know that Iqbal Lahori has many poems in Persian. I wanted to see why was he so interested in the Persian language and literature, and what was the influence of Iranian poets and thinkers on his thoughts and works?
Well, interestingly, if you see his work at that time, this was the generation of our grandparents. He was born when 20 years after the mutiny, 1857 mutiny that took place against the British rulers. So Iqbal, Allama Iqbal, was born in 1877. As I said, at that time, there was a lot of influence also of Persian language in this entire region. And interestingly also, the part I come from, Kashmir, which is also referred to as Iran-e-Saghir, prototype of Iran, there was a lot of influence of Central Asia. And if you go back like 600, 700 years and you talk about Mir Sayyid Ali Hamdani, who came to Kashmir thrice, along with his 700 companions, which are known as Sadat. And in that sense, the influence of Persian language, it was also a court language in the Mughal era. And that language was part and parcel of the entire social fabric. It was a language which was spoken by our, grandparents' generation. And people from that era also used to attend Maulud gatherings. And also in mosques, there were a lot of manqabat and noha. All of that was written in Persian language. It is sort of an irony that right now, this generation of ours does not have that kind of access to Persian language as people like Allama Iqbal had. So there was a Persian language was kind of a bridge that connected this part of the world to the Iranian civilization. So there was that's why we see a lot of poems like Saki Nama, in which there is a lot of focus on economic awakening of the Kashmiri people, which Iqbal wrote in one of the Mughal gardens called the Nishad Gardens. So you see, in that era, all the poets and all the writers from the subcontinent, the larger Indian subcontinent, they had a huge influence of the Persian language.
Mr. Gilani, we could say that with the beginning of British colonization and depersonalization of the language in this region, the linguistic connection that existed for centuries between Iran and the Indian subcontinent was lost. And what effect does this have on the separation of subcontinent culture from its ancient history and cultural heritage?
I would say the losses are huge. You know, if you allow me to go back a little, it was not only of the rise of British colonialism, but in Europe we saw at the same time there was European fascism and Muslim power was kind of in on a decline, and the kind of role that Allama Iqbal at that time played with his kind of worldview and what he gained from his experiences and his long travels to Europe and his interaction with the outside Western world. So that became a kind of a bridge, and people started getting connected to it. And slowly and gradually, when Persian language got removed from the courts, from the main linguistic assets, so this automatically meant that whatever role as a bridge it played between the Iranian civilization and between the Muslim world and the people living in this part of the world, the Muslims of this world, so that connection got lost, and it kind of if you can use the word, it orphaned people of this land to this beautiful language, and through which other avenues and other windows were opened. So in that sense, it has been a huge literary loss. It has been huge in terms of civilizational kind of an assault by removing that language from the official as an official language and introducing other languages which people do consider were alien to them, because with this language there was an emotional attachment, and that's why I'm saying that it has been kind of people of this region have been orphaned of a wonderful language.
Thank you, Mr. Gilani. Thank you for being on the program.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
Since mid-October, Bangladesh has witnessed an abrupt increase in religious violence. These conflicts started with the Hindu religious celebrations after a post surfaced on social media in which the holy book of Quran was subject to disrespect in a Hindu palace of worship. This incident led to extreme violence and incineration of Hindu prayer houses, and was then met with retaliatory attacks against Muslims by Hindu extremists. A fire that burnt all the way across to Bangladesh and spread to a few other cities in India.
A spark that led to a devastating flame. At the time of the sacred Hindu festival of Durga Puja, a menacing picture in which the holy book of Muslims, the Quran, was disrespected, circled social media platforms and led to the outrage of the 164 million Muslim majorities in Bangladesh. The ensuing rage in a series of violent retaliatory actions by both sides led to a few deaths and left hundreds injured in its wake. Mosques and temples were burned down one after another, continuing all the way to India. Both sides accused the governments. Some were aiming their dissent at the secular government of Sheikh Hasina Wazid and her silence against the disrespect by the Hindu minority that comprises 9% of the population. On the other hand, the extremist Modi government is accused of spreading anti-Islam policies in the country, which has to power a new wave of extremist groups in India. Experts have warned that if India and Bangladesh do not take immediate action to de-escalate the violence, the memories of killings from previous decades could come to life again.
Divide and conquer is the fundamental policy of the British Empire's colonization of the subcontinent and the source of all the pessimism and contradiction between India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Although historical evidence proves that the various societies in the Indian subcontinent have never experienced absolute unity before the colonization, and there have never been any real distinguishing characteristics between the religions in the area, the differences have remained rather vague. But the division that was established by the colonialist masters eventually led to the segmentation of the subcontinent in 1947 according to religious differences, a festering wound caused by the hypocrisy of colonialism that the people of the subcontinent still suffer from every day.
History has proven that whatever takes place in India, as the largest country in South Asia, will create a significant ripple effect in the entire region. Bangladesh, with its ties during its 50 years of independence, has significant bilateral ties with India, along with their historic and cultural bonds. India was very helpful during the Bangladeshi fight for independence against Pakistan in 1971. This shared history and common historic bitterness of both states towards Pakistan have brought the two countries close and helped strengthen the bilateral ties between the countries through decades of cooperation. In the past decade, the bilateral agreement in 2015 aimed at resolving 70-year-old border conflicts has fortified relations between the two nations more than ever. But there is a darker side to this relationship. With the rise of the extremist BJP in India, the country is on a declining path towards Hindu nationalism. This change in approach has had an undeniable impact on Indian foreign policy. Discriminatory policies implemented by the Indian government over the past few years, such as the citizenship law against Muslims, have negatively influenced the feeling of unity between India and its neighboring Muslim countries. India's gradual transformation to an ultra-nationalist state has been triggered by the Hindutva policy or Hindu First policy. It is an obvious threat to bilateral ties between India and Bangladesh, brought about by strong ties between the leadership and the relations between the people of the two countries.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Roshan Mohammad Saleh, an editor at the British Muslim news website Five Pillars. Now, Mr. Saleh, welcome to the program, first of all. Recently, tensions between Hindus and Muslims in Bangladesh and India have intensified, and some have been killed and injured. But what is the main root of violence in this region?
I think there's always been tensions historically in that region, in the subcontinent. But I think the latest round of violence basically started when social media rumors circulated about a Quran being desecrated in Western Bangladesh. And that obviously led to a lot of anger. And then there were attacks on Hindus. I think people did die, unfortunately, in those attacks. So things just kind of spiraled out of control to a certain extent. And then you have the so-called tit-for-tat attacks across the border in India. But I think generally we can say that region, there have been tensions historically, especially since partition, when the British Empire, you know, basically ran away from India. And, you know, you had lots of communal violence in 1947. Then you had the secession of Bangladesh, East Pakistan from West Pakistan. That led to, you know, tensions as well, because India helped Bangladesh achieve its independence. And then most recently, you have the rise of Hindu nationalism embodied by the BJP ruling regime in India and its leader, Modi. And of course, there's this open wound, which is Kashmir, So I think historically the region has been a bit of a tinderbox, but it's been exacerbated lately by the rise of Hindu nationalism.
Now, Mr. Saleh, Hindus are a religious minority in Bangladesh, and Muslims in India have almost the same situation. What is the relationship, if there is any, between the recent religious violence in Bangladesh and India?
I think there's no doubt that there is discrimination against minorities in both countries, but I do think it's a little bit misleading to compare India directly with Bangladesh. Bangladesh, I mean, it prides itself on being a secular state where everyone is equal under the law. In practice, the Hindu community have complained about discrimination, and I think some discrimination has taken place. But I don't think it's as systematic as it is in India, where you have a ruling regime which is discriminating against Muslims in the law, for example, through legislation, and is also encouraging its supporters to attack Muslims, where there is no redress whatsoever for Muslims. Whereas in Bangladesh, the authorities are now arresting people, arresting Muslims, in effect, for attacks on Hindus. I doubt if the same thing is going to happen in India, because you have this kind of open season on Muslims there, which is encouraged at the highest levels of the Indian regime.
So, Mr. Saleh, who benefits from this religious strife and religious violence in the subcontinent? Who is the main winner and loser of this bloody violence?
Well, I think no doubt the biggest losers are people of the region. The Muslims of Pakistan, the Hindus of India, the Muslims of Bangladesh, the Hindus of Bangladesh, the Muslims of India. You know, it ultimately doesn't suit any of them, and everyone loses with this constant tension and, you know, war footing that these countries are on to a certain extent. You have a nuclear powered or a nuclear, you know, a nuclear India and a nuclear Pakistan. I think who benefits, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that the Americans would like to keep the subcontinent divided. They don't want Pakistan and India becoming friends, and they kind of have relations and influence over both sides, and I'm sure they're inspiring some of this tension. We also have Israel, of course. Israel does not want a Muslim nation.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Saleh for his precious time, knowledge, and insight. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Salman Said says, since 70s till 90s, 75,000 lucky Kashmiri Muslims lost their lives in two nation conflicts in 25 years, and many women were also raped. Kashmiri Hindus in 1990 died in hundreds, and others had to leave, and the reason was the government and political issues, not a particular community's ideology. Mayak Pandey says, in this match, we have to forget all our internal conflicts and just support our nation. Firstly, we all are Indians, and then we are Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Christians, Buddhists, and so on. Anwar Hossain says, the conflicts between different religious groups, especially Hindu and Muslims, in Indian subcontinent was the divide and rule policy of the British colonialists. But we were so stupid to understand that. This divide and rule policy was so smoothly planned that we were busy fighting each other, hate each other, while they were ruling and looting us in every possible way.
And that was our episode about the shared elements of the cultural and linguistic identity of Iran and the subcontinent, and also the sudden increase in religious violence in Bangladesh. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In March 2010, with Tea Party activists protesting loudly in the hallways of Capitol Hill and the political wind in their faces, 34 House Democrats, including Representative Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, broke with their president to vote against passage of the Affordable Care Act. The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by Jonathan Wiseman, who is congressional correspondent and a veteran New York Times journalist. The piece is titled, Painful Changes in Society Ease Passage of Bold Safety Net Measures. March 2010, with Tea Party activists protesting loudly in the hallways of Capitol Hill and the political wind in their faces, 34 House Democrats, including Representative Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, broke with their president to vote against passage of the Affordable Care Act. It was not enough to kill the bill, but more than enough to register deep concerns about its reach in American society and its potential impact on the midterm elections. On Friday, 19th of November, 2021, Stephen Lynch and every other Democrat but one cast votes for about $2 trillion in spending on social welfare and climate change programs that arguably go much further than the health law, further, in fact, than any government intervention in half a century. And the concerns that peeled so many Democrats away from the health measure more than a decade ago were hardly in evidence, at least on their side of the aisle. I've served a couple of times in the minority, a couple of times in the majority, said Mr. Lynch, the last remaining House Democrat who voted against Barack Obama's signature domestic achievement. I've got a better sense of time and how these moments are rare when you can seize on something and make real change. The political and economic shifts in the United States in the decade between the first vote and the second may explain how a party still divided could unite around legislation of such sweep. The worst public health crisis in a century laid bare economic stagnation in the middle class and the soaring wealth of the super-rich in America. The recovery from the coronavirus crisis is still held back by childcare costs and poor educational access that have kept parents home instead of working. Searing heat waves, record wildfires, and waves battering hurricanes have underlined the reality of climate change. And the killings of black men and women, captured on video and spread instantly around the world, raised awareness of racial injustice and inequality, just as new generation of progressives was rising up in the Democratic Party. I've always said, courage comes out of crisis, said Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington and the leader of the nearly 100-member Congressional Progressive Caucus. You just couldn't ignore this stuff anymore. It was intolerable to watch. Those forces appeared to unite Democrats as they made their way to the Capitol to vote. There were no shouts from angry opponents like the ones that greeted Democrats in 2010 as they prepared to approve the Affordable Care Act. The main barrier to passage was an 8-hour speech by the House Republican leader, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California. Beyond the chamber, the only activists in evidence were a small clutch of supporters singing old union songs and someone dressed like the Build Back Better Act, modeled after the bill in the old Schoolhouse Rock video. The social safety net and climate bill still must navigate a tortuous road through the evenly divided Senate, where a single defection would bring it down. If it is able to clear that chamber, it most likely will have to go back to the House for a final vote, devoid of some of its items that drew Democrats to support it on Friday. But if it is enacted, it will touch virtually every American life, from birth to death, akin to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal or Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society. Its generous subsidies for childcare and universal pre-kindergarten are designed to lift the struggling working class into a less precarious economic position. Ample housing support, more higher education aid, and worker training programs in the bill would reach well into the middle class. Home and community health care, a new hearing benefit for Medicare, and price controls for prescription drugs would ease the lives of older Americans. All of that could reasonably be described as big government excess, and Republicans have made that case repeatedly for months. The scope and cost of the bill, if anything, is understated by its roughly $2 trillion price tag, because Democrats kept the cost down by phasing in some measures and arbitrarily ending others well before the expiration of the bill's 10-year window, some after a single year. In all, according to the Committee for a Reasonable Budget, if the entire Build Back Better Act were made permanent, the 10-year cost would be $4.9 trillion, which would exceed the inflation-adjusted 4-year cost of the Second World War, as Kevin McCarthy charged repeatedly over 8 hours. Yet a combined assault by business organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, their political operatives at groups like American Action Network, and the intense focus on the Republican Party against what they call socialist early education, crippling tax increases and dangerous limitations on drug companies was not enough to peel away even 4 House Democrats, the bare minimum that would have been needed to defeat the legislation. Competitive races next year will test whether voters embrace Republicans' grim view of the package or Democrats' belief that they are delivering vital programs that will be broadly appealing. Representative Tim Ryan, a Democrat from the working class region of Ohio who is running for an open Senate seat, said Republicans have dug themselves a political hole by railing against the bill. They're getting themselves in a position where they're putting themselves against universal preschool. They're putting themselves against controlling childcare costs for people, putting themselves on the other side of a tax cut for families, Mr. Ryan said. You know, people have been screaming socialism for a long time, and Roosevelt got elected 4 times. social welfare and climate bill is not yet law, but to have gotten it even this far was a prodigious feat, and what that probably happened only because of the societal and economic changes that preceded it, Democrats from across the spectrum of their party say. Look at the millennials in my district who can't afford a house, who can't afford to pay back their student loans, who can't even dream about living the lives their parents lived, Representative John B. Larson of Connecticut, a veteran Democrat, said. You can't tell people they're doing better than they are. As society has changed, so has the Democratic Party. Representative Jamal Bowman's New York district stretches from the wealthy suburb of Scarsdale to the tougher streets of Mount Vernon, and for 32 years was represented by white establishment Democrat Elliot Engel. Jamal Bowman, a progressive black man who defeated Mr. Engel in a Democratic primary last year, said his constituents acknowledge wealth inequality and income stagnation in their midst, in part because he won't let them deny it. If they try to look the other way, they really can't, Mr. Bowman said, and they know that whether it's through government or private industry or both, we have to do more to close the inequality gap. Republicans are still betting that voters will fixate on the spectacle of a Democratic president struggling for months to unite his divided majority around his agenda. They argue that a chaotic and deadly withdrawal from Afghanistan, rising inflation, and unsteady economic growth have only added to a sense that the country is in a drift, and say they're not about to allow Democrats to use the society, the social safety net bill, to distract from these concerns. We have a supply chain crisis that continues to rage on, exacerbating the skyrocketing prices and scarcity of goods our citizens are experiencing, the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy said on Thursday. And ask yourself this, what has this chamber done, especially this week, to alleviate any of these pressures on our fellow citizens, the people we were sent here to represent? The answer is absolutely nothing. Passage of the bill, Republicans say, will only stoke inflation, force the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates, and create stagflation, the combination of stagnant economic growth and rising prices that doomed Jimmy Carter's presidency. Democrats contend that their policies will offer real relief. Economic trends indicate a need for targeted assistance to the working and middle class, and it would be paid for largely by the richest Americans and largest corporations. In 2010, a moderate Democrat was socially liberal on issues like abortion and immigration, but fiscally conservative on government spending, and many of them voted against the Affordable Care Act. Today, a new brand of Democrats have emerged who are fiscally populist, but more circumspect on progressive social causes like immigration, defunding police forces and pressing responses to racial injustice. They voted for the bill on Friday. Republicans warn that Democrats will pay a steep political price for doing so. They point to the accelerating pace of retirement announcements, the latest coming on Thursday, 18th of November, from Representative G.K. Butterfield, a senior black Democrat from North Carolina, who would face a difficult re-election if a Republican gerrymandering district map for 2022 passes court muster. Who can blame these Democrats for retiring? Kevin McCarthy asked, almost taunting them before the vote. They see the writing on the wall, and they know this reconciliation bill will be the end of their Democrat majority, and for many, their congressional careers. Mr. Butterfield, who noted he was 74 years old, said on Thursday night that he appreciated Kevin McCarthy's sense of humor. Mr. Cartwright, who in 2012 unseated a fellow Democrat in northeastern Pennsylvania because he had voted against the health law, said he did not fear the Republican attacks to come. Republicans have opposed things that help ordinary working people for generation after generation after generation, he said. They spoke of downfall of civilization when Franklin Delano Roosevelt came up with Social Security.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So today we want to talk about one of the recent achievements inside the Islamic Republic of Iran, and that is COVID-19 vaccine, known as Cov Iran Barakat. You know, really under different sanctions which are put on Islamic Republic of Iran, Iran has achieved producing, I mean, the mass production of these vaccinations throughout Iran, and these mass vaccination program started from November, enjoying the domestically produced vaccine. So, Sayyid Murtaza, let's start with you, brother. It's really a shocking news for Iran and for the world, because it could produce its own national vaccine, Cov-Iran vaccine. Of course, there are also some other variations of vaccines inside Iran which are used, but still it is a very surprising achievement for Iran, isn't it?
Of course it is. You know, when it comes to the health and health issues, any medical achievements can be considered valuable.
That's right.
And at this time that most countries are experiencing a kind of very terrible outbreak of this terrible pandemic, I mean COVID-19, around the world, Iran has been one of the few countries that actually plan to produce its domestically produced vaccines.
Yes.
And Cov-Iran Barakat was the first one. This has been considered by many medical scientists as a great achievement for probably two very significant reasons. First, Iran has been experiencing a kind of sanction that was imposed on Iran by America and other European partners.
Yes.
To America.
Yes.
So, you know, when sanctions are in place, you know that it's very difficult to have and keep your partnership with other nations.
Yes.
On the other hand, we have limitations.
Yes.
Domestic limitations. It shows that Iran was actually very much pressed by national and international actually sanctions.
Yes.
So when such an achievement was made.
Yes.
And it was introduced to the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
Even America, medical institutes around the world didn't believe it.
Yes.
And they thought maybe it's just a kind of propagation or propaganda that Islamic Republic of Iran is making.
Yes.
About its medical development.
Yes.
But a few times later, it was proved, it was seen, and it was actually used.
Yes.
By many other nations. And now Iran is ready to stage a new progress.
Yes.
And it is going to be exported.
Yes.
To other countries.
And also the official, you know, scientific documents are being approved by WHO, I think. They're being sent. Okay.
Yeah, of course. And after like 14 months.
Yes.
These medical researchers.
Yes.
And all the papers have been sent to the international bodies to be viewed.
Yes.
And it has been approved and confirmed.
Yes.
So we can see that based on those international and some kind of national limitations, Iran took a very
yes.
firm step to produce that domestic vaccine. And
okay.
It has been considered not only by international but even by global institutes as a great achievement for the Iranian medical science.
And this has been it's been about a decade, for 10 years, we are under the harshest sanctions from the U.S. side, especially during Trump administration. Even the medical equipments have been, you know, sanctioned by the U.S. and its European allies, you know, and nothing was sent to Iran. We could see that how much the people, especially those who have specific diseases in Iran, were suffering from lack of medicine in Iran. But this Cov-Iran Barakat coronavirus vaccine, which is known to be effective more than 90%, you know, and this is a good one, I think, is a surprising news for us. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, let's get to you, brother. So how did you find this achievement for Iran?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it was a big achievement for Iran, and it has many, you know, it gives us many lessons to learn, especially to the countries in the region that do not fear or have the fear of so-called superpowers, do not have any fear of the sanctions. Generally, the governments, you know, they do not, you know, go further because of the sanctions, or they do not do the things which is beneficial for themselves,
that's right,
for their own people, because of having the fear of the sanctions. Whereas we can see in the peak of the sanctions, Iran has made its own vaccine,
that's right,
which is very much effective as well.
Yes.
And on top of that, we can see like only after 3 days, when the Iranian-made vaccine was made publicly, the U.S. Department of Treasury dropped its sanctions from the medicines,
yes,
from sending the masks, I don't know, the yes, vaccines and all those.
So it was during Biden administration, yes, I think, yeah.
So okay, basically, before that, Iran was under the sanction, yes, that they cannot have any vaccination from outside the world.
Yes.
They cannot have any masks.
Yes.
I don't know the other equipments, medical, yes, equipments. But obviously, the Iranian scientists and the Iranian nation, they have shown that they can do whatever they want. And I think that the sanctions have made or have made them stronger, and they have no use anymore,
mm-hmm,
like the sanctions that are on the Iran. And this is also some of the analysis of some of the, we can say, people like in the West as well. They say like sanctions are making Iran more powerful rather than weakening them.
Okay.
But on top of that, obviously, there is a role of a leader in,
mm-hmm,
it. And that's very important.
Yes, yes.
Because from the beginning of the COVID, we can say, like when COVID was started, we can see that the leader, the supreme leader, has ordered his nation or the scientists to make their own vaccination and do not depend on others.
A foreign one.
And this,
right,
this is very important,
yes,
that you need to have someone who shows you the way,
yes,
the path. And on top of that, the blessing is that your nation listens to you,
mm-hmm,
and they obviously really do what you want.
Right.
So it's a two-way, basically, we can say, participation. And we can see this from the beginning of the revolution. Even before the revolution, when Imam Khomeini was there, obviously it was the Iranian nation who basically listened to his orders, and they started their activities according to what the leader was saying.
And medically speaking, Iran has achieved many developments as progress after Enghilab, you know, after,
yes,
the Islamic Revolution. I could vividly remember that before Enghilab, you know, most of the doctors and the physicians that the presence in the offices in Iran were for Indian ones or the Pakistan ones, okay, from around the world. But after Islamic Revolution, I mean, we could see this boost of, you know, presence of the university students in the field of medicine. And then, you know, nowadays in Iran, in every city of Iran, you could find the best physicians, you know, and specialists.
Yes.
Especially, for example, this city, we are producing program from the holy city of Qom, you know, is the place of the outstanding, you know, physicians and specialists on different, we can say, fields of medicine. And this is really an honor for the Islamic Republic of Iran to produce such generation of the people, young and faithful. But as you said, that's right, believing in yourself, in your talent and the power in order to produce, because the leader has said ban the vaccination from the US or Britain. This,
yes,
does not mean we oppose the foreign, right, development. This means that we want to believe in ourselves, okay?
Yes.
And we believe in our vaccination.
And the way he just had,
yes,
the dose of the Iranian-made vaccine,
yes,
that was a big,
yes,
step, you know, by a leader confirming that whatever our scientists do, we,
yes,
believe in it.
Yes.
And there is no doubt in
the... And
the
trust that the Iranian,
yes,
people had on Barakat, you know, vaccination was really fascinating. Still going on, the mass vaccination is going on in Iran. Okay, Sayyid Murtaza, you know, there have been also so many other vaccinations, you know, the Razi vaccine, the Fakhra vaccine, but these Kov Barakat, you know, become very much famous about Iranians. Do you believe, too, that the sanctions made Iranians to believe in themselves, too, more than before?
You know that necessity is the mother of invention.
Yes.
So we have to look into this proverb and sayings that if you are just coming under great limitations, and if you are taken to the corner, So there is only one way you can actually defeat and fight back, and that's your personal strength and personal beliefs and your own self-confidence. We have seen, for example, in the ring, we have two boxers. One has been taken to the corner and he's been beaten up. So there is only one way for him to defend himself, not only to defend himself, but also to defeat the opponent, is to refresh himself, go all the way back and review his ideas, opinions, before he was getting into the ring.
That's right.
So the same thing happened to the Iranian medical institutes. So when all these sanctions by international communities have been imposed on them, they had no choice other than believing in their own abilities, other than believing in their own human resource. So Iran, fortunately, is enjoying a great deal of,
yes,
scientists,
yes,
and the human resource is really a good part of it. So Iran used two things to produce this vaccine for the first time, and on top of all, it was Barakat COVID-19,
yes,
so as a vaccine. So it was the human resource that they were backed and supported by the political, religious officials. And also we had this great tech that,
yes,
was that has been produced and developed over the past 42 years,
yes,
after the revolution, in the year 1979.
Yes.
And it is known as the Islamic Revolution.
That's right.
So these two factors made the medical institutes in Iran and anyone involved in this process,
mm-hmm,
very much successful to produce for the first time this Iranian vaccine.
And Iran has a rich history and legacy of producing vaccination. We know that all the infants who are born in Iran are vaccinated, you know, by the national produced vaccines inside Iran. So there is a long, long history to important, you know, vaccine research institutes in Iran, Pasteur and Razi, okay, which of course Pasteur is the French word, getting back to before Enghilab, but it's still active, and Razi, you know, after Enghilab. You know, these are really great achievements that are made by Iranians. Okay,
one more point,
okay,
is that now Iran has been actually fighting back with different waves of this virus attack across the country. So again, many medical institutes around the world have been greatly surprised that how Iran actually fought back and controlled these waves of attacks.
That's right.
That is happening. And these days you can see we had this fifth wave of attack.
Yes.
And now Iran is boldly announcing that this attack, wave number five, has been under control.
Under control,
and
that's right.
They have also showed to the whole international communities that they are strongly able to control the wave number six,
yes,
and it's not going to happen.
Yes.
So it shows that producing vaccine was a great achievement,
yes,
but controlling different variants,
mm-hmm,
is one point.
Yes.
Controlling different waves of attack is another thing.
Yes.
So I think Iran and medical scientists, institutes, all together made a great achievement.
Yes.
And I think that is a record that has been made,
that's right,
by the Iranian officials in terms of medical development.
Especially if we just take a look at the Muslim lands, we could find rarely a country which has depended on, we can say, its own produced vaccination, and Islamic Republic of Iran as an Islamic land is among these exceptions, Said Mohsen, isn't it? How much do you think these religious faith and belief had helped them in order to do so? I mean, have these independence, you know, as a Muslim land, Islamic land?
Well, obviously, we know that being a Muslim, we should be, if you're at a status or if you're at the state, you have a responsibility.
Yes.
You need to think that you're the servant and you need to do your best.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the main idea of the Islam, that wherever you are, you must, you know, strive for the best effort that, or the best potential that you have. Obviously, you need to go for the best. And that's what we can see. Making a vaccine is not just for the Iran, rather we can see the scientists like Fakhrizadeh was behind the big projects. Why they were behind those projects, it wasn't because of just Iran, it was because of the Islamic Revolution. It was the belief that they have that we need to serve this community and we are the servants, because in the Islam we have this ideology that what you do, you need to put your all efforts. And if you put your all efforts, then that is the state where you are worshipping Allah while you are working as well.
Yes.
So there is this concept is there in Islam. Like if a student is studying, if he puts all his potential, he's at the same time when he's studying, he's at the same time worshipping Allah. Worshipping Allah does not mean to just pray, you know, five-time prayers and, you know, fasting. Yes. It's not like that. So, yes, Islamic beliefs are there. Obviously, the beliefs have a big, effect on it. On top of that, you know, we believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we always have hope of the best.
That's right.
So this hope always, and this ideology that He is always helping us, and, you know, we have this dependence on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, in the Quran also we have a verse where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said to the Prophet that if wa in tawallaw, if the whole world turns away from you, faqul hasbi Allah.
Yes.
You need to just say Allah is sufficient for me, and there is no god except Him. Wa huwa rabbul arshil azim, and He is the Lord of the throne. So this ideology that is being put into the different, we can say, different levels of the people.
That's right.
And this ideology, it also helps. And that's why being a Muslim land, especially in the Islamic revolution of Iran, the achievements that we see, it's because of this ideology. Right.
Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen, for a nice elaboration. And Sayyid Murtaza, thank you very much, brother, too. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints, which was about the domestic COVID-19 vaccine inside the Islamic Republic of Iran, known as Cove Iran Barakat, a really great achievement for Islamic Republic of Iran. For more information, you can visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.